Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Every week at this time, we select a topic that generally is not discussed in an honest, objective, and fair manner that is still relevant to the average person. And we find someone who is capable of carrying that hour and giving insights that empower our thoughts. Today, mass formation and the rise of a technocratic regime. My guest is Professor Matthias Desmet, and he is in Belgium today. He is a professor of clinical psychology, and he's on the faculty at the Department of Psychoanalysis and Clinical Consulting at the University of Ghent in Belgium. He holds a master's degree in statistics, which led him to evaluate the long-term cost of lockdowns and isolation during the early stages of the pandemic. As an expert in the psychology of totalitarian states, he has theorized that society has been suffering from what he terms as mass formation. Please make note of that. A kind of collective hypnosis that has won over large numbers of people to follow and obey governments' draconian measures regarding lockdowns, masks, and vaccinations, and to be uncritical in all of their ways of approaching these conditions. Now, this is serious, because right now, think of the people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Peter McCullough, or Robert Martin, and many others who've taken a look at what's happening and says something's wrong here. This doesn't make sense. Yes, there is a virus. Yes, it can kill people, especially those who are most vulnerable. But also, let's take a look at why we're standing up and marching to whatever order we're given. And the authorities, I believe, and others believe, are using this pandemic as an excuse to introduce things that otherwise, in the normal course of discussions, would not be tolerated. Meaning we have no debate, no free speech, no ideas that are allowed to be discussed to see what makes sense. The hypothesized, well, they're out of the picture completely. It's only those who have absolute beliefs. There's only one truth, and that is the official truth. How is this possible? But it is. It's happening now. But now, parts of this narrative are beginning to become, well, let's say, the house of cards is falling. Do any of you remember the great psychoanalyst Sheldon Wallum, emeritus professor at Princeton? He was one of the leaders of the free speech movement in the 1960s. He described inverted totalitarianism as a form of managed democracy where the state governs everything, and also with the intelligentsia and the corporate and financial sectors. He didn't say the democracy was overthrown. Rather, he said it was neutralized. People are seduced into believing that they have liberties. They don't. They have their consumer pleasures. You can watch 1,000 different television channels if you wish. If your vote means something, which many of us believe today it means a lot less because those who control it, then you're suffering from classical totalitarianism. And we're seeing this now. Now, he passed away. I interviewed him several times and several years ago in his mid-90s. But let's take a look at these theories he had and then compare them to the mass concept of a form of mass hypnosis. Past models of fascism no longer apply, according to them. Klaus Schwab is saying, we have a brand new fourth industrial revolution. We have the Great Reset, and every one of these countries' leaders, Trudeau in Canada, Boris Johnson, Joe Biden, the heads of France and other countries saying, yes, we don't want to go back to the way anything was. Really? What about the best of the things in the past? No. Everything will be orchestrated by mass formation, and they're going to target the general population, but specifically the younger generation. And it's being done in schools. It's already in process. Now the pieces come together, and they're not at all questioning this. So, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you.
Would you please begin by explaining to this audience the larger issue that we're dealing with, and go into some depth. Take your time. There's no rush. about what your theory, your hypothesis is that could explain why so many people, especially in the United States and Great Britain and Germany, and are lining up not to question anything that is said. And the media is right behind them. They're not questioning it. And the scientific community in general is not questioning it. The medical community is not questioning it. And the people who are now telling us what to do are not even hiding anything. They're completely open, assuming that they have absolute power with no consequences. The forum is yours.
Yes, that was indeed what struck me from the beginning of the crisis, that many things in the mainstream narrative, as it was distributed through the mass media, seemed rather absurd and incorrect to me. And nevertheless, that most people continued to buy into the narrative, to go along with the narrative. And in the beginning, I was a little bit uncertain, so I took a skeptical stance from the beginning, to be honest. But in the first months, I studied the figures and the statistics and the mathematical models that were used in the media. And I immediately got the impression that all these statistics overestimated, often dramatically overestimated, the dangerousness of the virus. And by the end of May 2020, after a few months, it seemed to me that it was proven beyond doubt that indeed that had been the case, that indeed the initial statistics overrated the dangerousness of the virus. For instance, the mathematical models of Imperial College, which were the basis for the corona measures taken worldwide, predicted that millions of people would die within the first few months, by the end of May 2020. More specific, for instance, in a country such as Sweden, the mathematical models predicted that about 80,000 people would die by the end of May 2020 if the country did not go into lockdown. And Sweden did not go into lockdown. And by the end of May 2020, only 6,000 people died. And this figure of 6,000 was even only reached by a very enthusiastic way of counting, which means by including almost everybody who died. If you look at the statistics and at the data on people who have been dying from COVID, then you see that most people have 3, 4, even 5 comorbidities, other conditions, often severe conditions. So under normal circumstances, for instance, if we are counting people dying from influenza, from the flu, such people will never be included as victims of the flu. But now they were. And even then, in Sweden, the total number of people counted as COVID deaths was only 6,000, while the initial models predicted 80,000 people dying from COVID. So this shows that indeed the initial mathematical models and statistics dramatically overrated the number of people dying. And nevertheless, while actually by the end of May 2020, this was clear to everybody who wanted to see it, the narrative continued, and the same measures were taken, even while it was clear that the virus was much, much, much more, much less dangerous than initially predicted. That was one thing. A second thing that I noticed from the beginning was that, in a strange way, society, the population and the experts included, seem to be blind for a major and crucial part of reality in this crisis. That means for the collateral damage caused by the measures itself. From the beginning, There were numerous scientists who warned us that the measures might claim more victims than the virus. And for instance, the United Nations warned us in the first weeks of the crisis already that the number of children dying from starvation in developing countries could well be higher than the number of people dying from the virus, the number of victims claimed by the virus, even if no measures were taken at all. So, this is a strange thing, that at any time have we seen in the media, in the mass media, a proper cost-benefit analysis, a proper analysis, a proper comparison of, on the one hand, the number of victims the virus could claim, on the other hand, the number of victims the measures could claim. So that this were two things that really struck me from the beginning. On the one hand, this tendency to overrate the dangerousness of the virus. On the other hand, the strong tendency to neglect, to ignore the collateral damage of the corona measures. It seemed as if, in one way or another, society was blind for the collateral damage, for instance. And that was, by the end of May 2020, had, for me personally, it seemed that both tendencies were proven beyond doubt. There was this tendency to overrate the dangers of the virus, and there was this tendency to ignore the collateral damage. And that was a moment when I really started to think about how we could explain how such a strong, biasing, psychological process could be understood. How was it possible that an entire population became blind for the collateral damage and continued to buy into a narrative that so dramatically overrated the dangerousness of the virus? And a few months later, by August 2020, I could provide a theory which to me seemed to have the potential to explain what was going on. And that's, when I look back now, it's strange that it took me so long, because I had been lecturing on exactly this psychological process for years before the corona crisis at Ghent University. And I'm talking about this process of mass formation or crowd formation. So what is it all about, mass formation? Mass formation is actually a specific kind of group formation, which makes that the individuals that are in the grip of it, that are grasped by it, seem to lose all capacity for critical thinking and critical distance taking. And at the same time, also all start to think in the same way. That's something very typical. Le Bon said, it seemed as if all the individual souls are replaced by one group soul. So everybody seems to think, react in the same way, and people seem to be radically incapable of taking a critical distance of what they believe in and think rationally about their conviction or persuasion as a mass or a crowd. And it took me about 4 weeks. I worked day and night during these 4 weeks just to formulate or to explain the phenomenon of mass formation in such a way that also lay people who are not really familiar with psychology or psychological theories could easily understand it, and also to really understand the real logic of it. Because I had been reading a lot on mass formation, I had been lecturing about it, but it seemed that usually the phenomenon has been described, but it rarely has been really explained, the logic of it, was not very clear until then. And so I made an integration of that, what seemed to me the most important aspect of mass formation. And I wrote an opinion paper about it and published it somewhere in August 2020. And in one way or another, this paper was widely read and distributed here in Belgium, then in Holland, and later on, after an interview with Rainer Fulmich, it became also well known in the rest of the world, I think, or in a large part of the world. So, what was his theory all about? Well, if you look at mass formation is actually as old as mankind exists. It exists as long as mankind exists. Masses or crowds have existed always, but throughout the last 200 or 300 years, the phenomenon became increasingly strong and lasted longer. And this has everything to do with the fact that throughout the last 200 or 300 years, as a consequence of the industrialization of the world, and as a consequence of the use of mass media and this technology, in the first place, radio and television, later on the internet, more and more people started to feel socially isolated. And that is the core condition for large-scale mass formation. So mass formation emerges when a population is in a very specific state, which is characterized by at least four conditions. And the first and most important of these conditions is that many people should feel socially isolated or socially atomized, as Hannah Arendt calls it. And that just before the corona crisis, that was definitely the case. The US Surgeon General mentioned that there was a loneliness epidemic in the States. In Great Britain, Theresa May appointed a minister of loneliness because she acknowledged that many people felt socially isolated and connected only to other people through the internet. So that's the most crucial condition. And then the second condition is that there should be a lot of people who experience a lack of meaning making and sense making in life. And that's also something that was very clearly present before the corona crisis. A Gallup World Poll, for instance, concluded that upon being asked whether or not they considered their job to be meaningful, only 13% of the people answered yes, and 60% of the people answered absolutely not. So that's huge. The number of people who considered their job to be meaningless. Then, the third condition is that there should be a lot of free floating anxiety in society. That means a kind of anxiety that is not connected to a mental representation. If you're scared of a dangerous animal, a dangerous dog, for instance, then you know what you're scared of, and you can think of a strategy to deal with that object of anxiety. But if you feel anxiety and you don't know what you're anxious of, then you're end up in a very aversive mental state, because as long as you don't know what you're anxious of, you have the feeling that you cannot mentally control your anxiety. So that's an extremely aversive mental state. And then the fourth condition is that many people should experience a lack of a lot of free floating frustration and aggression and frustration, which, again, they cannot attribute to a specific cause or an object. So if these four conditions are met, a lack of social bond, a lack of meaning making, high levels of free-floating anxiety, high levels of free-floating frustration and aggression, then something very specific might happen. If under these conditions a narrative is distributed through the mass media, indicating an object of anxiety, and at the same time, providing a strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, then all this free-floating anxiety that was present in the population might connect to the object of anxiety, and there might be a huge and unexpected willingness to participate in a strategy delivered to deal with the object of anxiety. For instance, lockdowns, mask wearing, social distancing to deal with the virus. That has a first very important psychological advantage, namely that the anxiety, which was freely floating and which was extremely hard to control mentally, now is no longer freely floating, is connected to a mental representation, and can be handled by participating in the strategy provided in the narrative to deal with the object of anxiety. And then something else happens, something that is even more important. Because many people at the same time participate in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, a new social bond emerges. People feel connected again in a heroic battle with the object of anxiety. And that is the most crucial thing about mass formation. It leads to a new social bond, which is a very specific social bond. When people connect through the process of mass formation, actually they do not connect with each other. There are no new social bonds between the individuals, but every individual in itself is connected with the collective. So it's a social bond between each separate individual and the collective. That's something very, and the further the process of mass formation progresses, the more you see that the social bonds between the individuals deteriorate, and the stronger the bond becomes between the individuals and the collective. That's what typically happens, for instance, in totalitarian regimes, totalitarian states, which are always based on mass formation. So the totalitarian state is something completely different than a classical dictatorship, because totalitarian state, unlike the classical dictatorship, is based on the process of mass formation. And what do you typically see in a totalitarian state? That after a while, all social bonds between the individuals are destroyed, and the only social bond, there is typically a paranoid atmosphere in a totalitarian state in which people don't trust each other anymore. And the social bond between the individuals and the state becomes stronger and stronger until it is the only one that is still allowed. So you have this new social bond that emerges. And then also something else happens as well. All the frustration and aggression that was freely floating in society before the mass formation now becomes connected and directed at a very specific group. This means the group that does not go along with the masses, that refuses, that defies the masses. In this case, for instance, people who don't want to get vaccinated. When the Soviet Union, when the mass formations in the Soviet Union emerged, it were the aristocrats in the first place, or the large farmers who were the scapegoat, the object of the frustration and aggression in Nazi Germany. It were the gypsies, the Jews, and so on, who were blamed and victimized. But there is always that something very typical. As the mass emerges, as the crowd emerges, it will always create a scapegoat, which becomes the object of the frustration and aggression. And in this way, a highly negative and aversive mental state switches into a symptomatic positive mental state. So a situation in which people feel socially isolated, experience a lack of meaning making, feel a lot of free-floating anxiety, and are confronted with a lot of free-floating frustration and aggression, changes, switches to a situation in which people feel connected again in a mass, a crowd, in which they experience a new kind of meaning making through the struggle with the object of anxiety, the heroic battle with the object of anxiety, in which all their free-floating anxiety is connected to a representation and hence mentally better controllable, and in which all the frustration and aggression can be directed at an object, at people who do not join the masses. And so that leads to this a kind of mental intoxication in which the most crucial factor definitely is the new social bond, and in which this new social bond, this new kind of solidarity, this new kind of citizenship is the real reason why people buy into the narrative. That's crucial, because it shows that no matter how absurd the narrative becomes, or no matter how absurd the measures are, for instance, the corona measures, for instance, a certain part of the population, usually about 30%, will continue to buy into the narrative because it leads to the new social bond. It doesn't matter whether it is right or wrong, or correct or not. What matters is that the narrative leads to the new social bond, and the measures become a kind of a ritual through which the individual shows that the collective is more important than the individual interests. And that is exactly what rituals are, what ritualistic behavior is. Ritualistic behavior is always a kind of behavior that is meaningless and absurd from a pragmatic point of view, and that demands a certain sacrifice of the individual, through which the individual shows that it belongs to a collective and that it considers the collective more important than its own individual interests. So that explains why, no matter how absurd the measures come, no matter whether it demands sacrifices, no matter whether it goes against the individual interests, people still will continue to follow the narrative, to buy into it. Again, this only applies to about 30% of the population, probably about 30%. And as such, there is another very specific effect of this process of mass formation. It makes that people, that the field, that people's field of attention is getting narrower and narrower until it only contains this part of reality that is indicated by the narrative. That's something extremely typical. And all the rest seems to disappear into darkness. All the rest, even people's individual interests, have no psychological impact anymore. And as such, this process of mass formation is perfectly similar, even identical to most scholars who studied mass formation, to a process of hypnosis. In hypnosis, this is exactly what happens. A hypnotist focuses the attention of someone on one specific aspect of reality, and all the rest disappears from the field of attention. And that effect is extremely strong. In hospitals, when surgeons are confronted with a patient who is allergic to biochemical or chemical anesthesia, they will sometimes use, here in Belgium there is a hospital where this happens hundreds of times a year, they will sometimes use hypnosis to make someone insensitive to pain. And that works perfectly. A relatively simple hypnotic procedure is sufficient to focus the attention of a patient so much on one aspect of reality, on a, usually a positive aspect of reality, that the surgeon can cut through the skin, the flesh, sometimes even through the breastbone, in order to perform an open heart operation. That shows how extremely strong this focusing of attention is, and this narrowing of the field of attention is. And that also shows why people in this crisis willingly accept that they lose their personal freedom, their health, their wealth, their children's future, and so on, while following the corona measures. Something extremely strange. But I believe that this is what happens around us. And this is also what happened in the totalitarian states of the 20th century. Exactly the same happened. Process of mass formation emerged. Then, slowly, a totalitarian regime took advantage of this process and led people on a very destructive and self-destructive path. Well, that's a first attempt to describe the process of mass formation a little bit.
You've unpacked it very precisely. It is my belief that some countries, Australia and Austria, are now in the process of becoming fully totalitarian. Does mass formation explain the rise of intolerance towards opposing views that have also become epidemic today? I'm thinking of the woke and cancel culture and the entire ethos of self-centered entitlement that more people identify with today. You see it happening over the last 10 years in the United States, and now it is those who are leading the cancel culture who are able to make asinine statements that if you're born Caucasian, that you're automatically a racist. There's nothing you can do about it. Even to deny that you're racist is simply an excuse to double down on being a racist. Now, this is a form of racism. So the interesting irony is there's those individuals, that 30% or less, probably far less, who have embraced the woke culture and its cancel culture and its identity politics would never sustain a legitimate discussion or argument where one person is saying, I'm judging you solely upon the color of your skin and nothing else. And if that color does not coincide with what we consider a legitimate right to live and be employed and educated, then you should be shorn of all that. You should be living in an apartheid state. And that's what we're seeing in classrooms. That's what we're seeing in the pop culture and with a mindlessness. Now, on the other end of your argument, can mass formation create in people who are educated fully or in the process of being educated a sense of entitlement to disinformation, as if disinformation, bias, lies, and political or ideological conditioning is normal, and you embrace it because you identify with all the other people who are attacking anyone who is not that way, and your whole life each day is to wake up and attack and cancel other people, no matter what those people have achieved, no matter what their credentials, no matter what the rightness of their life. You dismiss everything. That's what I see. But I'm asking you, is this also possibly a part of your mass formation concept?
From the 19th century onwards, when the process of mass formation was studied first by such people as such scholars as Gustave Le Bon, it was well known that the process of mass formation always is associated with a radical intolerance for dissonant voices and dissonant voices So, and that makes perfect sense if you understand the internal logic of the process of mass formation as I just explained it. Before the mass formation, people were in a highly negative, aversive mental state. I refer to the four conditions that I just described: the lack of social bond, the lack of meaning making, free-floating anxiety, and the free-floating frustration and aggression. And the mass formation makes them switch to a symptomatic but positive mental state. And the dissonant voices, people who do not go along with the masses, first and for all have the effect that they threaten to wake up the masses. And if the masses wake up, then they would be confronted again with the initial, with these four conditions, with this aversive mental state. So people don't want to go back to the initial painful mental state they were in before the mass formation happened. And that's why they don't want to hear the dissonant voice, the dissident voice. They want to isolate from this kind of voices. That's the first reason. The second reason is that one of the conditions that give rise to mass formation is these high levels of free-floating frustration and aggression. So people always need an object to focus their frustration and aggression on. And it's perfectly logic that they choose as an object this dissonant voice. So there is two reasons why people are radically intolerant for other opinions and dissonant voices in mass formation, and it is both. On the one hand, these voices could make them wake up and confront them again with the initial psychological frustration and discontent, with the initial aversive psychological state. And second, they are the perfect object of frustration and aggression. That are usually the two reasons why this intolerance for dissonant voices exists in the masses. It's one of the core characteristics of masses. And if the process of mass formation becomes really deep, if the hypnosis becomes really deep, then the masses or the crowd typically starts to commit atrocities, usually towards the people who do not go along with the masses. That's extremely important to understand, that there is this spontaneous tendency in a crowd or in a mass to commit atrocities and to take as an object of these atrocities, as a scapegoat, the people who do not belong to the masses. And the better you understand that, and they typically, the masses typically do so as if they perform an ethical duty. And that also makes sense, of course, because the masses are always convinced that they show solidarity, that they show citizenship, because they, as an individual, disappear in the crowd and in the masses, in the mass. They are convinced that what they do is for the sake of the collective, happens out of solidarity, out of citizenship. So, and on the contrary, the people who are not going along with the masses, who do not buy into the narrative, are typically reproached to lack solidarity, to lack citizenship. And hence, it seems for the masses always as if it is a holy duty to stigmatize them, to isolate them, to even to destroy them under certain conditions. And the only thing that can stop the masses from committing atrocities usually is a dissonant voice that continues to speak out. So that's an extremely important advice that I can give to everyone. Try to continue to speak out. As Gustave Le Bon, mentioned in 1900 already, in the 19th century already. He said, if dissonant voices continue to speak out in a respectful way, but in a clear way, then they might not be able to wake up the masses, because that is extremely difficult. But they usually have the effect that the mass formation becomes less deep, or at least prevents it from becoming even deeper. So it makes that hypnosis becomes less deep, and that it does not reach this depth at which the masses start to commit atrocities. So that's something very important in the dynamics of mass formation. There always is this intolerance for dissonant voices, but it's extremely important that the dissonant voices still try to continue to speak out, because if this stops, if there is no dissonant voice anymore in society, then something terrible happens. And we have seen this typically around 1930 in the Soviet Union and around 1935 in Nazi Germany. At that moment, 1930 in the Soviet Union, 1935 in Nazi Germany, at that moment, all opposition was silenced in public space. So there were no dissonant voices anymore in public space. And at that moment, typically, the totalitarian state became what Hannah Arendt calls a monster that divorced its own children. It started to commit atrocities. First, these atrocities, at least within the framework of the totalitarian discourse, of a totalitarian theory, made a little bit of sense. So the communists tried to destroy the aristocracy, then the large farmers, and so on, just because these two groups, would never give up their private property. But after that, the aggression and destruction of the totalitarian state became radically absurd. The one group after the other was destroyed and put in the prison camps and in the labor camps in the Soviet Union. And the same actually happened in Germany. It started with gypsies, Jews, people with limitations, physical or mental limitations. But what most people don't know is that Hitler planned to eliminate also other groups, such as all the Germans with lung problems and heart problems, for instance. So the totalitarian state is always intrinsically self-destructive, and it always needs new objects of anxiety, which consequently should be destroyed. And that's also a radical difference with a classical dictatorship. When a classical dictatorship succeeds in silencing the opposition, the aggression of the dictator usually mitigates. It becomes milder, just because the dictator knows that at that moment he has to show to the population that he will be a good leader to them. He knows at that moment that he is in charge, and he has enough common sense. A classical dictator usually has enough common sense to realize that at this moment it is in his own importance, for his own sake, that he should mitigate his aggression. And it's exactly this common sense that is lacking in a totalitarian state. In a totalitarian state, it's the other way around. At the moment the totalitarian state succeeds in silencing the opposition, silencing all the dissonant voices in public space, that's exactly the moment where the aggressive potential of the totalitarian state is radically unleashed. So that's the moment where the totalitarian state becomes this absurd monster that destroys its own children. So that shows the importance of that the dissonant voices, the people who are not in the grip of this process of mass formation, continue to speak out.
Very well said, thank you. And I agree with you that people being silent is perhaps the greatest danger that keeps mass formation alive, and particularly the role of the voice as either initiating a hypnotizing effect, but also a means to break or disrupt a hypnotic state. Now look today, and everything you've just described is occurring. The Justice Department is now attacking anyone who challenges the official narrative on almost anything. For example, in a school, a parent who goes to a school board meeting in the United States and questions what is being taught in the curriculum, especially D'Angelo's book on white fragility, which is racist, they now become domestic terrorists. Now, for decades in the United States, the FBI has infiltrated every dissident group, whether it's an environmental group or a peace group. If you are opposing the corporatocracy philosophy or the government, you are now an enemy combatant. You have no rights. Now look at it this way. In the last 50 years, the FBI, the CIA, the National Security State, the intelligence agencies and subcontractors, not one person has been challenged and lost their job and reputation because of all the misdeeds they've engaged in, including murders and regime changes in dozens of countries. Obama and Hillary Clinton engaged in regime changes in 7 countries. Not once have they been criticized for that, and they keep the media is on their side. They control the media. So the media, when it says something, they say the same identical thing. The actual sentence is the same. Vaccines are safe and effective. Now they're saying you will own nothing and you will like it. Their words, not mine. You will own nothing and you will like it. But a reasonable person who is not hypnotized will say, well, hold on a second. You mean my house that I've worked hard for, my car, my bank accounts, the cash or gold or silver? I'll own none of that? And the answer is yes, and you'll be better for it. But we don't ask who then will own it. So who's going to take charge of it? Oh, a special corporate entity working with the government, and then you'll rent everything that you have. That is creating a welfare state. That is creating, and they're working on it, and they're not hiding it. None of this is hidden. I've played tapes of Klaus Schwab in 2016 at the World Economic Forum meeting saying that they're going to put chips in everyone, and these chips will be able not just to identify their health, but also all their banking material, all of their social media, everything about a person. And then later in 2020, along came Elon Musk talking about, well, we're going to be able to help you with brain conditions. But now that's evolved into this form of transhumanism. We want to know what you're thinking so we can make sure that you have no thoughts that are counterproductive to society so you fit in like a Chinese social credit score. If you're doing what they like, reading the right material, not protesting, or protesting what they want you to protest, then you get merit. If you don't, you get shut out. Now they're pushing big time for a cashless society. And no one seems to pay attention to the fact that how can they get away with this? How would the average person say, okay, if you're going to make me, let's say, if you're going to take care of all my needs, I'm going to be on permanent welfare. And I like that. I don't have to do anything I don't want. You're going to have robots take care of my daily work. You're going to do all this. You're going to have the law professional be gone because artificial intelligence will know more about how to handle law and history of law and than any human being would. So you're eliminating all these entire industries, making us, for all intents and purposes, a ward of the state. But we'll be comfortable. We're going to have all these virtual realities. You'll put on this headset and you'll program in what you want to see, and there it will be. And don't worry about not having a good sex life or any sex life, depending upon your age or your looks or whatever. You're going to be able to buy, and we will take it out of your account that we control, the perfect sex partner. But let's say it's not about sex. You just want someone better than someone who's going to argue with you about some issues. You don't want a wife or a husband. So now you got the perfect husband, the perfect wife. What do you want him to look like? How do you want him to talk? Because now they can think for themselves. In fact, they're beyond human control. That's where we're at, by the way, right now. And suddenly, you don't have to worry about being lonely anymore. You don't have to worry about what I call the big empty. The big empty, this perpetual sense of angst, this sense of dread, unspecific, nonspecific. And now you have someone who will answer every question, share every emotion that you need, and never argue. Oh, that's great. And so we start looking at what they're telling us will be the reason why we will give up all of our possessions and be happy. Don't worry about food anymore. You won't have food lines. You won't have homeless people. They'll package it to make it look humanitarian. It is not. It is dystopian in a way that Orwell could not have imagined. So that's what I see coming with the Great Reset and what you're talking about, this whole idea of mass formation and its four principles of how you become mass hypnotized. In effect, we saw it in Nazi Germany. We saw it with Pol Pot. We saw it with Mao and his Cultural Revolution and the Gang of Four, including his wife, that destroyed all art they could find, all intellects. As you said, those who are capable and who have a history of protesting will be the first that will be excluded. They will literally have to go underground. They will live like in one of these movies where you got the up and the down. The down are permanent apartheid, and everyone realizes, get them, kill them, imprison them. Just 2 days ago, one of the leading hosts on CNN stated that you should be able to die if you're not vaccinated. You shouldn't be allowed in a hospital. I thought that was just incredible that there was no blowback from the liberal community. And I'm embarrassed by the liberal community because I've been a part of that my entire life. But that has nothing to do with me today. I disown it in its entirety because its principles have not become those of caring for all life, seeing that all life is sentient and should be appreciated, and where all voices should be entertained. You can exclude what someone has had to say. You don't have to engage it, but not censor them. Now it is the left censoring everything. It's today's McCarthyism is the left. It is corporate Democrats headed by Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, and who probably represent the best case of transhumanism because no one could be born as absolutely lethal in all discussions as they are, or attitudes so cold and disheartened. So that's what I see coming. Could you address this, please? We have about, we have about 10 minutes left. So you can finish it off from there. And by the way, if I've said anything you would disagree with, please offer the challenge to what you would disagree with.
As I believe that what we are confronted with now, all mass formation, or all the large-scale mass formation and totalitarianism, starts from a certain ideological conviction, ideological persuasion, which was historical materialism in the Soviet Union, which was race theory or social Darwinism in the United States, in Nazi Germany. And now I agree with you definitely that the ideology that is now seizing power in society is transhumanism and maybe technocracy, if you want, something like that. But if you look at, if you take a closer look at it, I believe you will see that from the beginning of the tradition of enlightenment, somewhere in the end of the 16th century, the beginning of the 17th century, Western society and Western culture became more and more convinced that the universe and the human being is actually a materialist, mechanist phenomenon, a material phenomenon that can perfectly be understood in a rational way according to the laws of mechanical, according to mechanical laws. And contemporary transhumanism, which believes that mankind can overcome the limitations of its condition through emerging of the human being with technological devices, well, that actually is only the ultimate consequence of this initial conviction that the universe and the human being are a mechanical and material phenomenon. And there he stumbled upon something strange, because if you take a closer look, then you see that it was exactly this materialist, mechanist view on man and the world, and the ensuing industrialization of the world and the use of technology, that created the conditions for large-scale mass formation. In the first place, this social isolation and loneliness I have been talking about, because it's very clear, if you look at the global level, that the problem of loneliness is correlated to a very high degree with the level of technology use and industrialization of a country. The more use of technology there is, the more industrialization, the more loneliness in a country. So that means that in the final analysis, in the ultimate analysis, the conditions, mass formation, is actually a consequence of the materialist, mechanist view on man and the world. And at the same time, the problems that are created are promised to be solved by the same view on man and the world that created the problems. Einstein said something very nice. He said, you can never solve a problem by using the same kind of thinking as the one that created this, that created it. And that's exactly what we do all the time. Every time we believe that the problems we are in now, so we have this climate change and all this stuff, all these new objects of anxiety that are put forward in our society, to the extent that they exist, they are usually a consequence of the materialist, mechanist view on man and the world. And nevertheless, it is exactly this discourse, this materialist, mechanist discourse, that promises to solve the problem. And now we see this to the extreme, and with the contemporary turn towards a transhumanism and technocracy. Indeed, as you said, everybody who wants to know how this transhumanist ideology thinks it can solve, or it should can solve the problems of the world, can take a look at the website of the World Economic Forum. You will find such concepts there as the Internet of Bodies, referring to a society in which all human bodies are saturated with nano chips or other chips, and then controlled through a powerful internet. So that's probably the way in which certain people believe that the problems of our society can and should be solved. My opinion is that this ideology is not a solution, but that it is exactly the problem itself. As long as we look, as we consider a human being as a mechanistic entity, as a kind of a machine, then we will constantly create the conditions that lead to loneliness, psychological suffering, to a lack of existence, a lack of meaning making, and ultimately to the destruction of all humanity in our society and in this world. The only cynical advantage of totalitarianism and mass formation is that in the end, it is always self-destructive. It will always destroy itself. And as soon as you realize that, you also know that the only thing that you have to do is to connect with everybody who refuses, who defies this ideology, connect as much as possible, resist, say no, create a parallel structure, a parallel society, which can function for some time, more or less independent of the mainstream society, and then wait and see how this ideology we have been referring to destroys itself, because that's what it will do.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us today to discuss mass formation and the rise of a technocratic regime. I look at their side, their meaning the establishment, the corporations that are all working together, and their supporters in the media and the scientific, medical, other communities. And at this moment, they seem to have virtually all of the power of policymaking and opinion leading on their side. They have Wikipedia, which is, I've written 70 articles trying to show people the truth of what this publication is, or this information source, where anonymous people can do whatever they want to your reputation. And by the way, they'll probably do it to your reputation as well. And then good luck trying to change anything. All of us who have been skewered on there, we cannot reduce it. But as you also said, and so in such a clarion way, that we have to join together. We have to come together as united sentient beings saying, no, we're not going to vote for you. We're not going to buy your products. We're not going to buy your dresses and suits made in Bangladesh. It's slave labor. We're not going to eat your processed foods. We're not going to watch your polluted media and listen to your moronic comments about why we should submit ourselves to this. And that is where we're at this moment. And all the people, all the dissidents who were all orthodox, they were part of the establishment who now have been attacked, they're all fighting back. I've never seen that in my career, where the orthodox fights the orthodox. So we have some good leadership, and Dr. McCullough and Dr. Martins and many others. And you now will certainly be a guiding voice, because what you're bringing into this discussion is not just about the sciences being wrong. All of us have known, or all of us who care to have looked as scientists, have seen that everything has been wrong with this narrative, and hence the consequences, and immediately your attack for that. But this is the beginning of finding our voice. In Europe, they're finding their voice. In France, their voice. In Belgium, their voice to some degree, but not in the United States yet. Not enough. Not in Ireland. Not in Scotland. A lot of places still have to get the population out of that stupor that they're in and get them awakened, the real woke, to awaken from your conditioning. That's where we have to go. So, Professor Matthias Desmet, thank you very much. Keep up the great work. We will continue to post your videos and any articles on our forum. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you for inviting me.
I'm Gary Nall. We want to thank all of you for watching and listening. And please, if you find there is value, and only if you find there's value in what we have shared, pass it forward. We don't have the media. We have word of mouth. We have our voices. Share this, please. Have a nice day.